Everyone faces questions and decisions that require insight and answers as we move forward personally, professionally, and corporately in all areas of this thing we call life in America today. Hello, this is Joe Schofield, and I invite you to tune in every Monday evening from 6 to 7 p.m. as we talk together and hear from key leaders of all ages and backgrounds about your questions. Interesting, informative, intuitive, but always encouraging. Tune us in on BBS Radio Network.
Join Pastor Joe and co-hosts Commander Rob Hansen, Nancy Hansen, and Dr. Paul Hall in Raising Expectations.
Well, hi, everyone. We're apparently not able to talk to Dr. Joe. This is Commander Rob. I'll be happy to give a small intro to our special guest tonight. We live in a time where there are very few real role models and even fewer real heroes.
I can hear you.
But they're plentiful if you know where to look.
I can hear him.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you,
Can
yes.
you hear me, Rob?
Oh, I can hear you now.
There you go.
Hey. Hey, you two look really good.
There you go.
I'll continue.
Yeah.
I was just talking about how we live in a time where there's very few role models and very few real heroes, but they're out there if you know where to look. I found both during 20 years of active duty naval service, yet few get known outside the military, since the media seldom covers such role models and heroes. One of the finest role models I've ever known is our very special guest tonight. He's a decorated naval aviator, a superior naval officer, an attack pilot, and he'll be able to explain that, who became the commanding officer of the USS Ronald Reagan, which is no small accomplishment, let me tell you. And later became a rear admiral, and that is also no small accomplishment. I'm honored to have known him and to have served with him on at least three deployments. He even taught me a lot about what the attack community does as opposed to the fighter community. Back in my day, the F-14 Tomcat was just a fighter. It later had an air-to-ground capability and later became what we called the Bombcat. But when I was flying, it was just designed to shoot down other airplanes. Jim's job as an A-6 pilot was to drop ordnance on target, which is really the primary mission of the aircraft carrier, to put weapons on target. A lot of people don't necessarily know that either. He helped me get qualified as an air wing strike leader during one of our detachments up at the Fallon Naval Air Station in Nevada during our normal air wing workups between deployments. We have to train, we have to get people qualified to do certain things, and then go out to sea quite a lot. And we also spend about 3 weeks in Fallon, Nevada, honing our strike skills or our air wing team skills in the air. Fighter guys doing fighter stuff, attack guys doing attack stuff, electronic warfare guys doing electronic warfare stuff, and so forth. I'm very excited and very proud to introduce Rear Admiral Jim Simons. He's a warrior, he's a leader, he's an intellect, and he's a real officer and a gentleman in the purest sense. What I want to do is, I don't want to do all the talking like I normally do during these shows, okay? I want to make sure that I let everybody else ask questions and do the talking. So, first of all, welcome, Simo. Welcome, Admiral. It's great to have you here, and thanks so much for coming. I'd like to kick this off, and then I'm going to turn it over to everybody else, including the Admiral, to ask a question that probably everybody wants to know. What is it like to be in command of 5,000 men on a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier?
Well, Rob, let me start with, those are some
very nice words, and I truly appreciate it. And
this is to show I'm not talking.
It's hard to think that I could live up to all those very nice words you said. Let me first say, it is very gratifying to be asked to be on your show, Dr. Joe. I appreciate it very much. I'm certainly glad that I crossed paths with my shipmate of three deployments, and that Rob hunted me down so I could be here today. And obviously, you know Rob, and so you know we naval aviators love to tell stories, and certainly about ourselves. Well, certainly fighter guys do. But at this time of our life, it also is very special. Just like when I get to put on my uniform, to remember all of the wonderful experiences that I was so lucky to enjoy in the United States Navy. I was so fortunate to be able to work for and with the best and brightest our country has to offer, who volunteer their time, and they come from all over the country with all sorts of different talents, and we mold them and we meld them into wonderful teams who carry out incredible endeavors like, and we'll talk about this, all the different parts, all the different choreography of something like an aircraft carrier, which is marvelous to watch. And then through incredible shared experiences like the depth and challenge of a long deployment, become such amazing friends through that camaraderie. Those deep shared experiences create deep and lasting friendships. And I couldn't have imagined when we started this journey so long ago that it would be so rich, and that at this point in my life, I could call on so many friends all over the country like Rob, and we fall in together as if it was yesterday that we were cruising together. So I hope I've been able to tell you how important this is to come on and get to share some of this with you. To be the CEO of an aircraft carrier, when Rob and I were JOs, I didn't want to know the CEO of an aircraft carrier, let alone think that I would ever be one. And so I was very fortunate in my career to be shepherded along, kicked along sometimes by very good leaders who pointed me in the right direction. I was blessed with excellent timing, and so I got that opportunity as we give aircraft squadron commanding officers get the chance to go into this pipeline through nuclear power school, which could take another whole hour if you wanted to talk about nuclear power school, and that entire pipeline, which is how we build carrier commanding officers. And it's a tremendous adventure filled with ups and downs and lefts and rights and a lot of complex learning going on there. And it's three different jobs, as a matter of fact. After a year and a half, which is the longest schooling and temporary additional duty that I had through my career, I got to be the XO of Dwight D. Eisenhower. And the genius of one of the first parts of genius of this whole program is putting you in the second in command position, where below decks, the captain has kind of got the bridge and I kind of had everything else, which is what my wonderful commanding officer said to me. Below decks, you get to learn day to day what wonderful experts we have throughout the ship, what wonderful leaders we have leading the 16 departments, some of them larger and several of them larger than other ships, 600 folks in a department. And the wonderful depth and breadth of experience throughout the officer corps and the senior enlisted corps and the young sailors and how bright-eyed and bushy-tailed they are. And so through that 2 years, you learn, if you're, I think, if you're observant, if you're paying attention, that you get a lot of help. I'm asked quite a lot, well, boy, wasn't that a big responsibility to be the CEO of an aircraft carrier? And I say, yeah, and I got a lot of help. And that first tour as the XO gave me the perspective of all that help. And so I think I learned that if I was smart, I would let those folks do their wonderful job, allow myself to think maybe on a little higher plane, and certainly not try to micromanage those great folks doing their jobs. And then after that tour, we get to go and command some other ship. Some people call it training wheels. It's sort of your opportunity to see if you can get through that tour okay, and therefore get the chance to go in front of a board to see if you're going to get an aircraft carrier. And I had the command of USS Nashville. It was an older amphibious ship. So I got to go on deployment with 400 Marines, which was another outstanding experience. They're wonderful, wonderful folks. And I learned so much from that. Of course, all of us have tremendous respect for Marines. And the more you learn about them, the more you love them. Right, Rob?
Yeah.
And so I got to spend several months on deployment with those wonderful guys, and it was just a tremendous experience. And so after that, it's only after those two tours, and nuclear power school and those two tours, that you actually go in front of a screening board to see if you'll get an aircraft carrier. And so that by that time, you're sort of biting your nails, and is that going to happen? And I happened to be in Miami at U.S. Southern Command at the time when I found out, yes, I'd screen for command, and let me tell you, it didn't matter where I was going or what I was going to do. It could have been called the USS Rob Hansen and home based in Reykjavik, Iceland, and it would have been fine with me. But instead, about another month later, I found out, you know, it was going to be the USS Ronald Reagan, and I can tell you that hit me like a brick, because. And Rob will tell you, and all of our peers at that time will tell you, that Ronald Reagan was our absolute favorite guy in the universe. He made it, for those of us who were in the Navy at that point and in the military, he made it honorable to be in the military again. He made it honorable to serve your country. And he filled us with such enthusiasm and resolve that we all looked up to him like he was our father. So for me to know that I was going to have some association with a man that I admired so much meant everything. And so I was quite buoyed up. And now the only other part about it was 19 months before I was going to take command. And sometimes, as we, you know, as we say, there's a little bit of hurry up and wait in the military. And so, the wonderful thing about that whole pipeline, the training, it's the only, when I got to Ronald Reagan and obviously get introduced to the different folks and get the lay of the land. And mind you, this was a brand new commission ship, We went to commissioning on a very, very hot day in July in 2003. Mrs. Reagan was there to bring the ship alive, and the Vice President Cheney was there. And I was very fortunate to take command 6 weeks later in late August of 2003. This is the one job in my entire naval career where I did not need any turnover. I knew what I wanted to do, and I knew how to do it on day one. And that's because of that wonderful, deep learning that I was put through the other jobs. And like I say, especially that job as the executive officer. So to say, and in fact, I think the first thing I said in my speech that day at a change of command was, okay, now I'm excited after 19 months. And so onward and upward after that. And it's just the most exhilarating thing ever to walk around the ship on the next day and, how are you doing, Captain? And so I think that kind of gives you a flavor for what it took to get there. And I can, let me go a little further to say that exhilaration lasted through my entire tour. And the really important thing for me about command and this, the five different commands I had, and why people in command can't wait to go back, is the wonderful opportunity you have to affect people's lives in a positive way on a daily basis. And as the CEO of an aircraft carrier, I own 3,200 folks. And so that is, in the attack world, is what we call a target-rich environment. That means there are all sorts of people that whose lives I can affect, and I hope positively, daily. And that made my everyday very easy to get through.
Now, you mentioned, Simo, the ship's company, which is around 3,200?
At the time, yeah. It's usually around 3,000, yep.
Yeah, and then when the air wing comes aboard, that's another couple thousand folks, too.
Absolutely. They're going to bring another 1,800 or so, and then in that area, and then you've got staffs and everything. So when you deploy, yeah, it's over 5,000 people, mm-hmm. And the ship gets loaded out, and you with fuel and ordnance and all that, and you end up taking off 100,000 tons of, as I've read before, and I have on the back of my T-shirt, United States Navy, or United States diplomacy, which can go pretty much anywhere it wants.
Yep. Used to be called gunboat diplomacy.
Yeah, that's right. Going all the way back to the Great White Fleet. You're right.
Now, everybody, I don't want to talk. So,
anybody got questions? Go.
Yeah.
I can't hear Jim, Joe.
This is Paul. This is Paul, and I really appreciate. Thank you for your service. Thank you for the spirit that you have, and an obvious love for your personnel that you had charge of. So much today, as we are, when we're younger and we're building our careers and things like that, leadership is such an important issue, and oftentimes in different fields, leadership is not this principles of leadership are not necessarily taught. You, I feel that you sort of catch them by observation, and I really appreciate what you said about being under the wing and being mentored, tutored along the way. I'd just like to ask you a question. As you observed your situation and the people who would fill those positions, what kind of qualities and characteristics did you look for in an individual? Did you share that with us?
It's an excellent question, Paul, and I think I have the perfect answer. A lot of your experience in the Navy, and you hit the nail on the head, is a lot about leadership. A lot of experience in the Navy is about the sort of leadership you were exposed to in your first tour. You don't really have a handle on this yet. I mean, I was absolutely as green as an ensign as there was out there. I mean, I had very little big picture perspective on any of this. And I was lucky enough to, my first CO, a very charismatic, very caring, very, a gent who knew people, understood what it meant to motivate people, and was open to his people on a daily basis. You could tell by the way he looked at you, even when he looked at me with that eye, that I knew maybe I was a little in trouble. He cared deeply about his people. He was comfortable enough to talk level with the admiral on the ship and with our most junior deck seamen. And so that came through, I think, more than anything. I mean, he loved us like sons, and he spanked us like sons when we needed it. But that, he was the paradigm in that you wanted to be like him, in that we were discouraged if we ever let him down. That's the place you want to be in as a leader. Rather than browbeating people into what you would really like them to work so hard, because the idea of never ever letting you down is abhorrent to them. And so that was a paradigm for me. And number two, just, you know, in the short term, it's certainly what kept me in the Navy. I mean, if you had a leader who was not that sort, who really, and they're out there, who, and Rob and I have both seen them, who it's very clear are in it for themselves and are in it for what are great ego strokes as a CO, that is a lot less fun and it's a lot less enriching. So I felt very, very lucky. And I would say his name, Tim Thomas, he was his name, and he knows how much I love him. And later on, he got to put on one of my Admiral shoulder boards when I made Admiral, and I was so proud of that. And we continue to stay in touch. He comes to Arizona, and we play golf together. And I continue to consider him a tremendous mentor and example, and just a wonderful man. And so I took from that's really all about. That's what it's all about. And when I say to a young budding leader, what's most important? I say, well, if you care for your people, if you truly care about their professional and personal development, then this job will be very easy. Your way forward on how to make decisions and what you will do on a daily basis and all those things will be made easy. If you care about your future more than theirs, then this job will be very, very difficult.
Well put, sir. Now, when did you spend most of your time up on the bridge when you were underway?
Also a really good question. Now, you know the first answer to that question, yes, if there were night flight ops going on. Anytime we had night flight ops, which for those of you maybe unaware, that is the pinnacle of the challenge and the demand of operating on an aircraft carrier, and that's at night. It begins with how dark it is on the flight deck. It begins with the lowering of situational awareness for everybody on the flight deck. And that's why only those people who are qualified and who understand where to be and where not to be, that's where it starts. And then it's for the air crew, again, whose situational awareness kind of goes from all outdoors to sort of down through a little straw. And those professionals who have gotten to understand and how to precisely do what they need to do, taking off, landing on the carrier. That's the high end of challenge. It's the high end of anxiety. It's the high end of reward. And so certainly I was there then. Most times during flight ops as well, but when I was not at flight ops, I wanted to be out and about. I wanted to be seeing what sailors had to, what they thought, what they had to say. And I'll tell you what else. On a ship that size, it occurred to me that the deck seamen and the engineers and the young aviation bosun mates, like I said, when I was a junior officer, maybe they probably didn't even want to know the captain, and they certainly thought on a ship that big that they were never going to see the captain unless it was over a podium and under not so nice circumstances. So I felt like a very simple and a very meaningful thing I could do was just get around the ship, smile a lot, shake a lot of hands, ask how they were doing, and that sailor for a few seconds even, could say, you know what, the captain of this ship cared about what I was doing, and that spreads, you know. Obviously didn't get to spend time with every one of those sailors. However, as you well know, that sort of that story spreads. And so others kind of get the idea, you know what, the captain really cares about us, and that makes them more invested in what we're doing.
Yeah, I think. Go ahead.
I noticed that you had to do some nuclear training. How was that?
Very challenging. I was a math major in high school or in college. And mind you, the nukes really kind of like mechanical engineers, electrical engineers. Those are the guys and gals that are really prime because they've gotten a good, rich engineer. I didn't have a whole lot of engineering background. And so when I went through my, we all get interviewed at naval reactors when we get selected. And I took a little bit of fussing. Well, math, what makes you think that you're good enough to, you know, to get through our program? I think some of that was harassment. I think they were probably going to experience something. But I'll tell you this. At 43 years old, and I actually bought into this whole idea. You know, we were sailors, Rob and I, and we were known to put a beer or two away when we were younger, right? And I actually thought to myself, I wonder, and the whole thing about, you know, well, alcohol kills brain cells. I was pretty good at math, but you know, will that make a difference when I go to nuclear power school? It's very impressive. It's incredibly impressive. It's the purest academics there are in the Navy, because you're just not gonna get through by looking at your friend's paper or having somebody pull you through. It's 30 credits of fairly heavy engineering and reactor stuff in 6 months. Wow. So you're basically cramming a whole year into a semester. And we were impressed with that the very first night. Now, you go down for a couple of weeks of preliminary, okay, yeah, we get it. And mind you, we'd heard all the stories. You get a flavor from others who've done this. Yeah, it ain't going to be easy. But that very first night, we took a look at, there were three of us going through it together. We took a look at what was on our page for homework, and it hits you. I am going to be here all night. And we were. And because of the way they had it classified, you couldn't take it home. And we were there all night. And we were there all night, every night. And we were there 8 hours every Saturday and Sunday. And at least through the whole thing. Now, like I said, I had a good bit of math, but nothing like thermodynamics and nothing like electrical engineering. And I think I kind of took to it pretty well. And so finally, and you just have to get into that mode. I say it the way a gent who was, when I went through the interview process, and we stopped over the Pentagon first, and the nuke admirals pumped us all up. Okay, you're going to do fine. Just go over there. The nukes are going to, they're going to roast you, but it's fine. You'll get it. And one of them, and gosh, I can't remember his name right now. Very fine man. He recalled how he said, when he got put into the nuclear power school, he said, I realized I have been living my life at flight idle. In other words, way back on the power, because you have to ramp up very quickly and you cannot afford to get behind. And so again, that I just remember that hot feeling at the back of my neck that first night. Oh my goodness, this is going to be a lot of work. Well, and then halfway through it or so, you start to get into that mode, and you start to think and do things more quickly, and all that. And finally, I sort of got into the swing of it, and about halfway through, I actually was able to go half day on Saturday and maybe even take Sunday off sometimes, which is a big accommodation. So yeah, it spins you up very quickly, and it's pretty darn impressive. So even at 43, we got through it okay, but it was an impressive time. Mm-hmm. About it. It's a really good question.
Was Admiral DeMars naval reactors at that time?
Admiral DeMars conducted my interview, and it was in the for those of you who may not know, Admiral Rickover, his interviews are legendary. Absolutely legendary. Things like putting a guy on a three on a chair with one leg too short, or sticking him in a closet, or all sorts of cockamamie stories. And I finally realized, and those that ethic or that mode kind of went down through the admirals, and Bruce Damaris was the gent who gave me my interview. And I'll tell you, I don't know if you ever knew Pirate Barbary, Rob. He was in this same bunch with me, a fighter guy. And all I remember was passing Rob or Pirate on the way. He was coming out as I was going in. And you should have seen the flame coming out of his eyes. And I think from my interview, which was, I think it's all about, can he spin you up? And what will happen when he does spin you up? And what will be your reaction? I think for those of us commanders, I think it was probably dumbed down a little bit. Now, when you've got an incident there, you really do want to find out what he's made of as to whether you truly want to take this young gent or gal into your program. And so they fairly run him for the ringer in front of a four-star. And there's some that, okay, yeah, I'm afraid your reaction here is not what we were looking for. So, yeah, it was an experience, and obviously one I'll never forget. But, yeah, I knew Admiral DeMarsh.
During your command, Jim, what would you share as like the biggest challenge that you faced during your command?
Another outstanding question. I would say a couple things. Let me put one like this: the commander of the Pacific Fleet came aboard when we were out in San Diego later on, and we had dinner, and he said, "Captain, what keeps you up at night?" I said, "Well, Admiral, 1,000 19-year-olds whose concept of risk is different than my own." And so there's one of them. There's one of the challenges. And, you know, I used to, in taking folks aboard, I'd get to address the brand new young sailors. And I would ask them, where do you think I worry about you the most? And, of course, they think engineering and the flight deck and all that other stuff. No, it's on our nation's roads, because more than likely, that's where I'm going to lose one of you. And so it's a matter of your 19-year-old's concept of risk. We were all there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they're all really good kids. But the second one I would tell you, Paul, is on a brand new ship, one thing I learned that I didn't quite understand. It matters how long you've been on, how long since you've been on deployment. It matters to the seniority and the relative, really real experience in your crew. And that didn't occur to me until a little later on, a few months later, and some missteps and this and that. That this ship had never been on deployment, and therefore the experience that gets ordered in is only just so thick. It's not very thick. It's some chiefs and petty officers and like that. But you're missing all of the young sailors. When they've been on deployment within a year or two, they get it. They get so much more of what's going on here and what their role is. We didn't have it. And so that is something I wasn't prepared for, and something that led to some fairly serious missteps. And you know, we kind of got through those, but it's a little bit in that setting, understanding, because this was a newly commissioned ship, just exactly what we were in for, and the difference between that and what Rob and I were used to when we went aboard a ship. Hey, this is a going concern. They've been going for quite, and we just kind of melded into it. So that, another excellent question.
You did go through workups, right? I mean, you had, you know, RIMPACs or COM2Xs or, you know, your standard XC periods.
Yeah, because of the timing on it and my job, because it was commissioned in Norfolk, because we build all these ships in Newport News, it was commissioned as a Pacific Fleet unit. So my job really was to get it around to San Diego. And when I took command in August, it really wasn't finished. A newly commissioned ship, there's a lot more to do. So we went back into the shipyard in the winter And so we didn't take off until to go to San Diego until the following May of 2004. So that was my big deal, is to move 1,000 families from Norfolk to San Diego and get the ship around in good shape. And so then when we could start the workups, and we started, we began those workups with an air wing the next year. And by the time we got to the late workups and really getting ready for deployment, it was time for me to give up command. It was time for me to be relieved on time.
Okay, Stephanie, I think you guys had a question.
We both did.
Go ahead.
So I researched you, and I thank you for your service, and I saw that you've received many awards. I would like to know which one is the most special to you and why.
Wow. Excellent, Steffi. I've never been asked that question. It may very well be, now that I think about it, and I was in a squadron in the 87 time frame, someplace like that. It was one that surprised me, to tell you the truth. I didn't expect it. I was a tactics officer in a squadron, and we'd been doing a whole lot of work with, we had a new missile called the Harpoon, which is a air-to-ship missile, and fairly new, and we were building the tactics for it in the air wing. And you know, and of course, like I like to put it, I was head down and butt up doing all that work with the other tactics officers in the air wing, and trying to come up with how do we best use this to put the missile in the right place and yet keep airplanes out of harm's way against some fairly serious capability on Russian ships. Obviously, this was the Cold War. And trying to do our best to come up with it, I think pretty proud with some of the things we came up with. And all of a sudden one day at quarters, the captain called me out and gave me a Navy Achievement Medal that I truly did not see coming. It was a total blindside. And another wonderful man, tremendous CO, and I just was flummoxed because, I realized in that moment, sometimes you don't quite get, before you get to senior leadership, you don't quite get the difference that one sailor can make. And in that moment, it occurred to me that the skipper understood and was very appreciative of the contribution I was making, and obviously that was very humbling and gratifying. And I remember to this day feeling very surprised and shocked, and so it's an excellent question, and it's a really good memory. I appreciate it.
Thank you for your answer. Mm. I love it because it was unexpected, right?
Exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly the point, Stephanie. Yeah. You're absolutely right. We sort of got to expect that at the end of the tour, you know, you would receive an award commensurate with your rank and the position and all that. But that one, yeah, that one took me by surprise.
Mm-hmm. Craig, you got one there, like you were sharing?
I was just going to mention that it's interesting. In medicine, there's a thing called Six Sigma. It's a safety thing. So six standard deviations. And they use the aircraft carrier in a couple ways. One, it had a catastrophic fire that the crew responding to the fire were blown up, and they didn't have a second crew trained. And it taught them that you need backup and cross-training. The other was the takeoff of all those planes and the night flights and stuff. And their example was exactly what I was going to ask you, but you gave the answer, which was, the turnover of the crew made a big difference. The length of the deployment that they were on, and then how many of them, what percentage were being moved out.
Yeah.
That must have been during your time.
Well, as I said, I didn't make it to the deployment. And as somebody who had not been around a commissioned ship, I just didn't have the flavor for it matters how long it's been since deployment. And so since it had never been on deployment, the junior, inexperienced nature of the ship and crew was just not apparent to me.
No.
Hey, Jim, I have another question for you this fall. One of the churches that I had the high privilege of pastoring, we had a retired Marine colonel aviator, and he flew A-4s, and then he flew helicopters in Vietnam. I asked him, with all of his experience in flying, why he didn't go into aviation after he retired from the Marine Corps. And he said, after you've done all the zipping around, flat and level has no challenge whatsoever. And I really appreciated that answer. Now, that leads me to what I'd like to lead into next. I noticed that you you are a part of an organization called Golf for Warriors. Is that correct? Am I right?
Yeah.
Tell me about, obviously, you have a great love for people, and I really appreciate that. But how do you see applying all this wonderful experience you've had with bringing to these Golf for Warriors, these participants in that? How do you bring that to the table, and the degree of satisfaction that you must have in sharing your life? What are some of the things you see, and why this particular group of people? Could you answer that for me?
Yeah, it's an outstanding question, Paul. First, you have to know I was a Cold War guy. The closest I got to combat, Rob remembers, we went when Iraq invaded Kuwait. We were in the Indian Ocean, and that was on the 2nd. And by the 4th, we were on station. And the very next day, we thought there was some intelligence that said they're going to come down the coast to Iran. And so we were planning. I don't know if you remember that night, Rob, but we thought, well, it didn't happen. And that whole fall, we watched as forces moved and all that. Well, the independents had to come back to the country, to the country, and had work on it to do. And so we were going the other way while all my friends were flowing toward Desert Storm. Anyway, closest I ever got to combat. Well, and then as a senior officer, when the wars of the last decade started, it occurred to me how much water all of these young soldiers, airmen, Marines, sailors were carrying for us. And I guess even some of it is actually a little bit of, I didn't have to do that, but they're doing it for me. These young kids are doing this for me. And of course, those of us in the military kind of tend towards military history. Let me turn on the light so I start.
As the sun goes down here.
There.
Maybe that'll help a little bit.
Yep. You look into military history and you find how devastating it is to be in combat and how devastating it can be for the individual. And so we're all very fascinated by that. And so my thought was, what can I do? You know, how can I help? And it occurred to me that golf, and which is my great passion, is a difficult game, but it also is an escape for that reason, because it's so difficult and it's so exhilarating. The one time out of 10 that you can hit the ball in the center of the club and feel that feeling and see it go high and straight and all that. Well, what better escape for somebody who's battling PTS, as so many of our young returning military folks were. And I happened to meet, just willy-nilly, a retired Air Force pilot who was a PGA pro. He'd always been a golfer. And, he retired from the Air Force after his career, and he was flying for United. And we decided at lunch, we both had the same idea. He had the same idea I did to see if this, what we could do. And so that's when we established Golf for Warriors. And so free lessons for somebody who wants to get out, wants to see what golf is like. And I'll bet you amongst all of you, there are four or five sets of golf clubs in your garage just sitting there, you know, collecting dust. And that's what we, and so we tapped into that. And so we also give them a free set of golf clubs. And so, it hasn't for several reasons. The numbers of folks that we put through that are not as not what I wanted to have by this time, but it's continues to blossom. And I have seen some of exactly what I was after. I mean, one gent, very, very thoughtful gent, and you know, they're not going to tell you when you meet them, yeah, this is where I was, and there, but he was with the 10th Mountain Division, and I know enough to know that the 10th Mountain Division are some fairly special folks.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew that he was in the 10th Mountain Division, he was deep in it. And he said to me one day, you know, Admiral, I don't get out that much, and I truly appreciate what you've done for me. And I've had two or three others like that, and that has been absolutely worth the price of admission. And so it's just so enjoyable to get to spend some time with those young folks and get to take some of the things that I've learned by spending time with young people and try to see if I can help them sort of put things in perspective, learn from them, you know, what was it really like? What are they dealing with? How can I help? And so many of them are very appreciative that golf is a wonderful escape. And so that was the theory behind it. And I think in practice, we've kind of gotten to where I wanted to be.
We've only got about three and a half minutes here, but Rob, you know, Nancy, I'm sorry. You're leaning forward. Go ahead. I didn't hear you. You go right ahead. What have you got?
Okay. I wanted to ask Jim what it was like to present the flag to Nancy Reagan for me.
Oh my goodness.
I know we're short on time, but
Nancy, let me very quickly say I already told you what I thought of President Reagan. And so to have that sort of connection, let me very quickly take you through. We were going into Rio de Janeiro, and this is a much longer story, but I'll let you know that I didn't think this could possibly happen. And I told the chief of staff at Air Force specifically, that just can't happen. And hey, try the previous CO who's now an admiral. And he came back and he said, no, the family says they want the CO of the USS Ronald Reagan. So long story short, I flew from Rio de Janeiro. We pulled in on time. I flew from Rio de Janeiro to Los Angeles and to the site, and the wonderful ceremonial guard took me through everything that you do to present the flag to her, and that next day, in anticipation, you know, we kind of waited for the whole thing to happen, and it was a little bit late. And I don't know if you remember when they landed at Point Magoo there, it took them a long time to get up to Simi Valley because so many people were lining the streets. Mm-hmm. Well, the timing was absolutely amazing. If you look at that picture, you take a look at the shadow and it was level. I mean, in 15 minutes, it was dark. The timing just couldn't have been any better. And I have to leave you with this vignette. Ma'am, this flag is presented on behalf of a grateful nation as an expression of appreciation for the honorable and faithful service rendered by your husband. And do you think from the Thursday night until Friday night I practiced that 100 times? Yes. And do you think I want to do anything other than please don't step on her foot, don't drop the flag, don't, you know. And I got halfway through it. Ma'am, this flag is presented on behalf of a grateful nation. I think as I remember, she may have gone for her Kleenex. I absolutely froze. And it felt like 5 minutes. I think it was 5 seconds. And this is what I wanted to tell you. Wonderful Mrs. Reagan, actress, right? And I'll swear to my dying day, she kind of went like that. Just gave me the little hint of a nod. Okay, son, we'll get through this. and I got through it. And it was obviously, and my wife was able to be there at the same time. And it was obviously, for both of us, one of the highlights of our life and a tremendous honor. And the connection to Mrs. Reagan, as well as some small connection with President Reagan, is absolutely, I cherish it very much.
And there's a big picture of you with doing that at the Reagan Library, I understand.
Well, as a matter of fact, we went there a couple of years later, and I'm more than life size. After I've handed it to her, I stand up and I salute, and that thing is You know, this, so I was very surprised at that.
I can't see that.
I'm telling you, it's just such an honor. I can't tell you.
I know we're going to have to sign off, but what I'd like to ask you is if you would you come back and be with us again? Rob, wouldn't that be a great idea?
Yeah.
Oh, I think it'd be great. I mean, again, you know, there's a million stories that
yeah.
we all have from our time in uniform.
I was going to pitch one to you, Rob, say, give us a good story here. But, sir, what a blessing you've been to be with us tonight. We're going to look forward to working to have you with us again. You're the kind of person that makes me proud to be an American and proud to be a citizen. My dad served in the Navy, World War II, USS Montpelier, heavy cruiser. And thanks for being with us. We'll be back in touch with you because what a blessing you've been on this program tonight. And again, I'm sorry that I flunked up on the beginning of this, but we got the best team of people right here. You're never going to meet anybody better than these people. The five of these people could sail your ship for you.
Absolutely.
You better keep me in the kitchen in case I drop the chicken. But anyway, God bless you, sir. And we'll be back and we'll look forward to seeing you when we're back again. Rob, thanks for sharing. Everybody in the team, God bless you all. Love you so much. And we'll be back in touch real soon, okay?
Thank you so much.
Dinner's on me next time, okay?
Friends, thanks for joining us on this week's program of Raising Expectations. We profoundly hope you found it engaging and at times humorous, but most of all, uplifting, so that we may, with you, one topic at a time each week, become more encouraged to move forward to an exciting future in, as we always say, this thing called life in America today. So let not your hearts be troubled, your family, finances, faith, freedom. It can be a great future as we talk, listen, respect, and pull together. Please let me hear from you. You can reach me at 972-922-8556. That's 972-922-8556. Or Joe Schofield on Facebook or LinkedIn. It'd be a pleasure to know you, and we hope you'll listen in again next week on the BBS Radio Network.